Okay, so first I would like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present my work here today. So in line with the workshop's title, Intertwined Orders, I will also discuss some type of system which with intertwined orders, but on top of the usual conventional symmetry baking type of orders, we'll also show some very interesting interplay with topological order. So just to set up the problem, let me try to give a very broad introduction first. So Landau's theory, as we all know, has been tremendously successful in giving us some unified framework to classify different phases of matter. And the underlying principle is studying different particle symmetry and its breaking. And the simplest example, and which illustrate basically the entire notion of Landau theory, is the transverse field Ising model. So here we imagine some lattice model, and we place Ising spins on the sides. And the Hamiltonian consists of two terms. The first one is just a ferromagnetic nearest neighbor Ising interaction, and the second term is a transverse field term. The key point here is the Hamiltonian has a global Z-Dus symmetry corresponding to flipping the spins, and the two terms would compete and would lead to a zero temperature quantum phase transition, where in the limiting case where the Ising coupling dominates, the symmetry will break spontaneously. Here I've chosen all the spins to point up, and we end up in a ferromagnetic state. And as we increase the strength of the transverse field, quantum fluctuation would disorder the state, and would eventually lead to a paramagnetic state where the symmetry is restored, okay? And the main object, which is essentially the essence of Landau's theory, is the order parameter. And we can define a local order parameter. In this case, it would be the magnetization, which would distinguish between the two phases and characterize also the phase transition, such that it would be finite in the ferromagnetic state and would vanish in the paramagnetic phase. Okay, so at this point, we say, okay, are we done? Can we classify all phases of matter using Landau theory? And fortunately, the answer is no. And maybe not very originally, all the rest of the cases are typically called unconventional criticality. And again, just to illustrate this, let me consider some deformation of the well-known Torrey code. So the Torrey code is, in terms of degrees of freedom, is very similar to the Ising model. So here, instead of placing our Ising spins on the side, we place them on the bonds. And we have two types of terms, a star-like term. We take the product over the sigma x operator, and a plaquette term, for which we take the product over the sigma z operators. So now let me supplement this model with two field terms, one in the x direction and one in the z direction. Okay. So what you should notice at this point is that I've essentially broken all the symmetries of the model, all the on-site symmetries. And if we follow Landau theory, we don't expect to see any kind of phase transition. But curiously, if you plot the phase diagram as a function of the two fields, Hx and Hz, you see that you get a bunch of phases, an actual quantum critical point that separates them. Okay. So this definitely goes beyond Landau theory, because we get a phase transition in the model without any symmetries. Okay, so what's going on? It turns out in order to understand the nature of this phase transition, we need to invoke an emergent gauge theory description, and the transition is some kind of a Higgs or a confinement transition. Okay, so we used to think about gauge theories in the context of high-energy physics, where they correspond to actual physical particles that mediate the interaction between the fermions. In condensed matter theory, gauge theories are typically emergent, and maybe the classical example for that, just to make context to a more physical model, is a polynomial of dimer covering. So one can imagine that those dimers correspond to some singlet state. And now if we want to somehow label this quantum state, we have to assign quantum numbers. And the way that it's usually done is by placing Ising spins on the bonds. And the value of the Ising spin essentially tells you, or answers the question, whether you have a dimer or then specific bond or not, okay? And the remarkable thing here is that if you insist on enforcing the hardcore dimer constraint, which essentially tells you that each site belongs only to a single dimer, you get an emergent Ising version of the Gauss law, which tells you that the product over those sigma x's corresponding to those Ising spins here would equal minus 1. Okay? So in recent years, we've seen that gate theories play an increasingly more important role in describing low-energy theories in condensed matter physics. Some examples, spin liquids, Hall effect, Dieckhoff-Van criticality, and many others. Now, when one tries to study those theories, at least numerically, there's a very fundamental issue that at least at finite density of fermions, quite generically, those theories suffer from what is known as the numerical sign problem, which essentially renders any Monte Carlo calculation to be uncontrolled. So what I present today is a very simple, at least in the scope of people do more sophisticated stuff like CCD, very simple example of gate theory, which is free of the numerical sign problem, even at a finite density of fermions. And our main result would be a scenario where those two paradigm symmetry breaking and confinement seem to coincide. Okay. So now let's move on to the actual model. So first, let me just very briefly review the physics of the Ising lattice gate theory. Okay. So the Ising lattice gate theory is really the simplest example of a gate theory. So similarly to the toric code, our degrees of freedom are Ising spins that live on the bonds. Okay. And the Hamiltonian consists of two terms. The first term we already encountered is a Plaquette term. And the second term is a transverse field term. And now, just to make the analogy to the more well-known electromagnetism, we can construct the following dictionary. So the sigma z operator essentially corresponds to the electromagnetic vector potential, and the sigma x operator to the electric field. Okay, and unlike QED, there will be now binary variables which can take the value 0 or pi. Now we can also define a magnetic flux, which in this case will be either 0 or pi, depending on the parity of the spins along the plaquette. It turns out it's not sufficient just to specify the Hamiltonian in order to fully characterize the theory. One also needs to impose the equivalent of the Gauss law. It would be an Ising version of the Gauss law, which tells us that the parity of the product of the sigma x operator that emanates for each one of the vertices must equal unity. And now if you want to introduce matter fields, we need to modify the Gauss law to take this into account, since the matter field essentially act as a source for the electric field. Okay, so now let's see how do we couple this theory to fermions. The two terms here would compete and will lead to a quantum phase transition. So let's see how it goes. So first, if we go to the limiting case where the transverse field is very strong. So here the ground state is very simple. It's a product state where all the spins point to the positive x direction. So we call this state a confining state. And the reason is as follows. Let's imagine that we produce two test charges. Now, the only way that we can comply with the Ising-Gauss law is by connecting them with a string. Okay, and along this string, we flip all the spins. The cost of each spin flip is roughly h. And we see that the effective potential between those two test charges grows linearly with their separation, which would lead to a confining potential. And now if we go to the other extreme limit, where the flux term dominates, here the ground state would be a state in which there's a zero flux through each one of the plaquettes. And excitations above this ground state are described by a single spin flip, which would generate two pi flux phases, which are also known as visons. Okay, so now let's see how do we couple this theory to fermions. The way that it's done is by placing fermion matter fields on the sides of the square lattice and letting them hop. But in order to keep the the kinetic term gauge invariant, we must introduce some Ising version of the Pyle substitution, which physically means that the sign of the hopping term depends on the sign of the spins along the corresponding bond. We also need to modify the Ising Gauss law in order to take into account the presence of those dynamical matter fields. One needs to notice that those matter fields are only sensitive to the parity of the fermions and not to the actual number operator. So this is, of course, a very strongly interacting and complicated model, which we might hope to be able to solve in some limiting cases, but a generic solution would entail some numerical computation. And the key observation which makes this free of the numerical sign problem is the fact that whenever the gauge group representation is actually real, then also the fermionic determinant is real. And if we have an even number of fermions, then the Boltzmann rate associated with the fermions would end up being positive, and we essentially got rid of the numerical sign problem. Okay? So now that we managed to solve the sign problem, let's try to construct the phase diagram of this model.
One question?
Yes, of course.
If you wanted to have some other, further neighbor hopping, you would need to introduce spins on those bonds as well?
Introduce again?
If you wanted to have fermions that could hop, say, diagonally, or the second neighbor, you would need to have more...
Okay, so, yeah, so making this gauge invariant is slightly more subtle. Okay, so there are issues with that, but this can be tough. This simple model, we just took this minimal coupling, nothing too complicated. Okay, so let's first try to look at a generic filling case, okay, and try to understand how does confinement look like in the eyes of the fermions. Okay? So first, let's go very deep into the confining phase. So the only way that the fermions can comply with the Ising-Gauss law is by forming a tightly bound Cooper pair. Okay? And once we introduce quantum fluctuations, those can hop following this virtual process, which you can easily convince yourself that would lead to an effective hopping that goes like T squared over H. And of course, those Cooper pairs are bosons, and once they can disperse at low enough temperature, this would lead to a Bose-Einstein condensate. Now let's go to the other extreme limit, to the deconfining phase. So here, the fermions are essentially free, and they would fill up the cosine band up to the chemical potential. And once we reintroduce gate fluctuations, they would mediate weak but attractive interaction. And due to the Cooper instability, this would lead to a BCS phase. I added a star here, and this comes just to remind us that this is not a usual BCS phase because they live on the background of deconfined particles. Okay, so now let's specialize to the case of half filling or vanishing chemical potential. It turns out that there's a very surprising phase that arises if we look at the limit where the hopping amplitude is large. So in that limiting case, we'd have to perform the following exercise. We should try to minimize the kinetic energy of the fermions by picking some pattern of the gauge fit. Okay, so it turns out that this seemingly simple problem has a somewhat surprising solution. And it turns out that this would lead to a pi flux phase. Okay. And the key point here is that the pi flux phase is emergent. It comes from the strong interaction between the fermions and the gauge fields. And now, having a pi flux lattice has a very radical effect on the fermions, since the dispersion relation corresponding to the pi flux lattice has two Dirac nodes. And essentially, we have an emergent low-energy relativistic invariance in our model, which started from a completely non-relativistic model. So this suggests the following phase diagram. At low values of the hopping, we get a transition between a confining phase in which the symmetry breaks down in a BEC-like fashion, and a deconfining phase where the symmetry is broken down to a BCS-like mechanism. And as we crank up the strength of the hopping amplitude, we end up in an emergent deconfined Dirac phase. Okay? So let's try to study this model at different cuts. So first, let's take the slightly pathological but interesting limit, where the gauge feed is essentially frozen. We freeze all the dynamics of the gauge feed, and this ends up being an almost classical model. So this limiting case essentially corresponds to a competition between the tendency of the flux term to form a zero flux state, which happens as J is much larger than T, and the tendency of the hopping term to form a pi flux phase. And indeed, as we go to large values of T, we get a pi flux phase with emergent Dirac nodes. You can even find the location of the transition analytically. So now let's turn on quantum fluctuations. And first, let's study what is known as the weak coupling limit. So here, we start from a deconfined phase with a large Fermi surface and a zero flux state. And indeed, here, from the numerics, we see that the flux for each bucket approaches one, or a zero flux state. As we increase the strength of the hopping amplitude, we end up in the pi flux phase with Dirac fermions. And now, if we want to study the phase transition, it is useful to look at the susceptibility of the flux, or the flux fluctuations. And we see that we get a double peak structure. We have two peaks, which forces us to believe that there's some intermediate phase between the zero flux state and the pi flux state. The way that we interpret the intervening phase is that we have a confining phase, which arises due to the tendency of the Dirac fermions to effectively lower the strength of the flux term and eventually lead to confinement. So now, after we examine the Ising sector, we need to somehow diagnose the fact that we have Dirac fermions in our spectrum. So it turns out this is a non-trivial question. And the reason for this is as follows. So the single particle Green's function in the presence of gauge field is non-gauge invariant. So one needs to construct a gauge invariant observable which will detect Dirac fermions. One way to achieve that is by looking at the orbital magnetic susceptibility, which in the non-interacting Dirac limit, after proper rescaling, this observable would tend to unity. And indeed, we see as we increase the strength of the hopping amplitude, it asymptotically approaches unity, which gives us good indication that indeed we have Dirac fermions in our spectrum. So now, finally, let's go to what ended up being the most interesting part of our phase diagram, into the strong coupling limit. So here, we first go from a confining phase, okay? So we see that the average value of the magnetic field goes to zero, so it heavily fluctuates, up to the deconfined phase that forms the pi flux phase, and we see that the average magnetic field goes to minus one, or a pi flux phase. And now we can try to locate the position of the critical point, but again, looking at the susceptibility. And we see that we get a peak roughly at a hopping amplitude equals 1.8. And now we can also try to probe the symmetry breaking that arises at the confining phase. In order to do that, we look at the order parameter. And so here I'm plotting the order parameter as a function of the hopping amplitude. So indeed, we see that for low values of T in the confining phase, we get a finite value for the order parameter, which is vanishing in the pi flux phase with the Dirac fermions. So one should notice first that it appears to be a continuous transition, and second, that the coupling constant at which symmetry breaking kicks in and confinement kicks in seem to coincide. Okay? And this is somewhat non-trivial because without...
Sorry, could you go back?
Yes, of course.
So you showed us a... You showed us the order parameter for the superfluid.
Yes.
And you identified a peak in this susceptibility. How do you identify that also as necessarily a confinement transition?
So that's a good question. So actually, in the presence of matter field, there's no sharp observable which can tell you that you have gone from confinement to deconfinement. Okay? So essentially, the only thing we can actually measure is something analogous to the specific heat. Okay? So this is an energy observable. So essentially, what we observed is some sort of a peak in the specific heat. Okay? And since we see only a single peak, and we know in the two limiting cases that one of them is confining, the other one is deconfined, so this is the location of the phase transition.
Okay, so there's not direct observation, but you're relying on the known S-entires.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So without matter fields, there's something called a Polyakov loop that you can define, but with matter fields, there's a screening effect, which is essentially kills you, and you are unable to sharply distinguish between the two phases. Okay?
So, but given that, maybe it's less surprising that there's only one transition.
But if you want to write, let's say you want to write down some field theory for that. Uh-huh. Okay? So you would have to, okay, so you would guess that for the Dirac Fermion, you write some gross Naveau transition and you tune some mass term. But you would have to do the same thing for the Ising transition. So you can follow this formulation that Subir and Schenker had for the transition. So you think about some XY model couples with some Chern-Simons, and you have another mass term over there. So yes, it has to be a miracle that those two mass terms would vanish exactly at the same point.
Yeah, but I'm still a little confused, because if you can't sharply distinguish the two phases, how can there be a...
No, so you can.
You can
use the Wilson loop.
Yeah.
However, there's the concept of super selection sector. So this deconfined phase has a stable pi flux particle. So there is an excitation.
Okay, so they do have a sharp distinction.
There's a sharp distinction. Okay. There's a local excitation bison of the pi flux particle, which is a part. It's an excited state, so it's hard for imaginary time Monte Carlo to see it. But there's a stable particle which cannot be created by any local operator. Only pairs,
yeah.
And which is there in the spectrum. It's there in the spectrum in I guess in the blue, but not anywhere else. Or no.
In the
and
blue
the,
and the
orange.
In the orange, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Also, there's a way to do it in Monte Carlo also. Not this thing, but
it's entanglement.
They're very fine, like looking at entanglement, entropy, like secondary entropy.
Good. Right. So there's two sharp changes that occur somewhere here.
Yeah.
Okay.
In the thermodynamics, maybe it's hard to pick this up, I guess.
Yeah. So then are we sure that it isn't too distinct? I mean, it might not then show up.
You should see something should happen for the specific hit. Uh-huh. You have some singularity in your energy.
Sorry, the confinement transition, this is two dimensions, right? So presumably the confinement transition is not actually a transition at finite temperature, right?
Okay, so if you do proper scanning of space and time, this becomes a 2+1 dimensional system, which is 3D, and you have a transition. Yeah. You have to carefully do the...
Okay, so in one other question, we're sure that this isn't a first order transition.
Okay, so let's see. So again, without fine tuning, we expect either a first order transition or two split second order transition, where we first gap the Dirac cone, and then we undergo a confined and deconfined phase transition. That would be the more mundane scenario. Okay? And in order to check if indeed we have a new universality class, so a second order phase transition, we need to do some scaling analysis, which we indeed did. So here I'm plotting a curve collapse analysis of the symmetry breaking order parameter. And we see a nice curve collapse. Using the same critical data, I can also collapse the Ising susceptibility, which from I can extract the alpha exponent, and as a very non-trivial cost check, all of those exponents obey hyperscaling relations, okay? That relate the alpha exponent with the correlation length exponent. Okay, so this gives us further confidence that This is indeed the case. So I'm not showing here, but we have data on even larger system, which is highly consistent with that scenario. Okay. So, yes.
What is it? That's the Ising order parameter for what? Sorry.
This one?
No, what is the Ising order parameter?
No, essentially this is a collapse of the specific heat. Because this is the fluctuation of the magnetic flux, which is an energy observable.
You call it Ising susceptibility.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's just, yes, there's no.
What is it? It's a specific heat.
It's specific heat, yeah. Okay.
Just being Ising flux.
Ising flux, I meant, you know, just.
It's the energy.
Yeah, it's the energy. Yeah. Maybe it's better to Ising flux. So,
I wouldn't use the word Ising at all.
Okay, flux. Okay. It's a fair comment here.
So the data you're showing are for cuts at constant temperature or extrapolated to the zero temperature?
Yeah, so what we assume here is that those are an emergent relativistic invariance. So plots here are done by a different system size, and we scale the inverse temperature accordingly. So L equals beta, essentially. You assume that you have a three-dimensional classical phase transition. Okay. So before I conclude, let me just mention a few stuff.
Sorry, and these are exponents that are not characteristic, not the expected ones. These are.
No. This is okay. So eta is
huge.
So it's way off. Okay, you can say this is an Ising criticality, and then so eta for the Ising criticality is essentially zero.
Yeah.
Okay, and also for the Grosnevo, it's pretty far away. Okay, I think it's 0.7, and definitely the correlation at 6 points is very different. So yeah. The exponents do not match known critical theories. Yeah. So I guess the most pressing question is, hey, can we, that we're currently working on, can we find a field theory description of this transition? How do we force confinement and symmetry breaking to coincide? Second, can we introduce physical or gauge interval fermions, you know, to realize some kind of Fermi liquids? And can we extend this study to other gauge groups? Okay. And to summarize, I'm introduced a study of lattice gauge theory at finite fermion density, which is free of the numerical sign problem, which shows a BCS to BC transition driven by confinement, an emergent Dirac fermion, and a putatively a new universality class where symmetry breaking and confinement seem to coincide. Okay, thank you very much.
So you showed us, I think, mostly cuts as a function of t at fixed h. I'm wondering about at fixed t sweeping h between, say, the deconfined.
I'm not sure if I have the plots here, but essentially this is the usual Ising criticality because the electrons here are spectators. There are gaps throughout.
Gaps on both sides.
So so essentially it's the Ising criticality. So we were unable to prove that this is the Ising criticality because you have to go to ridiculously low temperatures in order to see the BCS transition here. So it was very difficult to prove that numerically. So the transition temperature is exponentially small here. So,
exponentially small in what?
So you have some effective weak interaction, which is mediated by the gauge fields.
Why is it weak?
There's some number, which is order one, but it's, you know, the range is exponentially small. Some number.
Over the gap of the gauge field.
Essentially, yeah. That would give you the.
Then it would get, wouldn't it get big as you approach the critical point?
Yeah, so it was easier for us to see that close to the critical point, but not But as you go slightly away from the critical point, it was almost impossible to see the transition.
Questions about the quality of the feature of the phase diagram. So at a very large H, I would have expected the, even the large the phase boundary, the difficult fine phase, the blue phase, seems to extend for a much wider region than the orange. Why is that a distance?
Suppose
I go to a very large H.
Yes.
I would expect everything to become confined.
Yeah, okay, so the slope here should be something like this. Yeah, no, the, okay, so it's a very bad schematic. It's not from the numerics, it's just a schematic.
It's
a sketch, so you should have some slope here.
The other peculiar thing is that if I fix H and then I decrease T, I go from confined to deconfined to confined, or the other way around. Deconfined to confined to deconfined again.
Yes.
Is there some qualitative way of...
Why you get this intervening confining phase?
Or why is the confined phase extend to H?
So, okay. So I cannot vouch for this area because it's very hard to do the Monte Carlo simulation because everything is almost frozen, all the dynamics is frozen. But what happens over here is that as you crank up the strength of the hopping, you essentially effectively reduce the strength of the flux term. It becomes more and more negative up to the point that it sort of almost crosses zero, and then if you have a very, even a small H or a small transverse field term, you get confinement.
So there's no Maxwell term here, which is the product of sigmas around the loop. You don't have any such term.
You have that one, so it's...
even though that term is there...
The
effective Maxwell term is zero or something?
The effective Maxwell term becomes smaller and smaller. So it should go from... The effective Maxwell term here is negative, because it's biflux phase, and here it's positive. So it has to somehow cross through zero. So when it becomes very small, then even if you have a very small transverse field term, you would get confinement. That's the point.
So at this point, for H equals zero,
yes.
At this transition, so that's not just the first order transition, you're saying all
It's a first order transition, this one. In the first thing, because over there it's just energy level crossing.
I see, but
it's a classical phase.
But it's not that all the flux states are degenerate at this point. It's just that you have the zero flux and the biflux phases which are degenerate, but
So over here, you just go, one of them wins, and what happens here is once you crank up the strength of the transverse field term, it would kick in.
If it's a first order transition, they would expect it to extend.
Yeah.
They have just a biparticle point.
Okay, so I don't have numerics for this one, so it's only a sketch. This part is it might be wise. Okay, I haven't done this, but you might be able to somewhat perturbatively in H try to figure out what's the structure here. So the numerics is very difficult over here. So yeah.
So all of your numerics is at mu equals zero.
Not all of them, but some. Yeah. The one I presented to you, most of them are
mu equals zero. So, at mu equals zero, is there a symmetry between the superconducting and the CDW state? So then actually TC is zero.
Yes. So what? Okay, you're right. So what with the simulation that we've done was at finite chemical potential, where you break this SE2 pseudo spin, and then you get a finite KT transition.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So.
These were actually done at small, at non-zero chemical potential.
Yeah, this is zero.
This is zero chemical potential. I'm not showing the due to lack of time. So we have some data on at finite density of fermions where you break that symmetry, and over there I was unable to see that this is indeed Dirac transition. I'm sorry, an Ising transition.
Any more questions? Let's thank you again.